You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB. This is Kathy Norton.
And I'm Kelly Worley. This is the Daily Local News for Wednesday, September 17, 2014.
It's an increased desire of individuals to live within walking distance of shopping and their jobs and recreation.
The public is invited to weigh in on the future direction of an expanding Bloomington. More later in the show in today's Community Report.
Also coming up in a new edition of our Consumer Watchdog segment, Bloomington Beware. For some con artists, seniors make a particularly vulnerable and therefore desirable set of targets. But first, your daily headlines.
Eli Lilly yesterday announced a partnership with UK drug maker AstraZeneca to develop and commercialize a potential new drug for Alzheimer's disease. AstraZeneca will produce the drug ASD3293, and Lilly will lead the clinical trials. The drug is one of a class of drugs called BACE inhibitors. BACE inhibitors inhibit an enzyme, beta secretase, which is involved in forming the plaques in the brain, one of the characteristics of Alzheimer's disease. BACE inhibitors are believed to be a promising target for treatment of Alzheimer's, but several trial drugs have been abandoned because of serious side effects. Last year, Lilly stopped trials with a BACE inhibitor it had developed after the drug was shown to cause liver toxicity. Merck also has a BACE inhibitor, MK-8931, in clinical trials. Developers of drugs to fight Alzheimer's disease have the prospect of big rewards with an estimated $5 to $20 billion in annual sales. There are also big risks. A recent study in the Alzheimer's Research and Therapy Journal found a success rate of just 0.4% for drugs in this field that were developed between 2002 and 2012.
Indiana Attorney General Greg Zoeller joined colleagues in 37 states urging the FCC to allow more extensive use of call-blocking technologies. Newer technologies such as NomoRobo, call control, and telemarketing guard allow phone carriers to identify and block a much larger portion of telemarketing calls. But phone companies are reluctant to use these technologies. They fear they could be fined under a ruling made by the FCC in 1934. This ruling says phone companies have a legal obligation to complete phone calls. Much has changed since that ruling was handed down. In recent years, the number of robocalls, as well as the number of consumer complaints about these calls, have increased drastically. To protect consumers from unwanted calls, the Attorney General is asking the FCC to allow phone companies to use call-blocking filters if requested by consumers. For now, consumers can cut down on unwanted calls by signing up for the Do Not Call list. This can be done online at www.indianaconsumer.com or by calling 1-888-834-9969.
The Alzheimer's Association raised more than $55,000 this past Saturday in Monroe County with its Walk to End Alzheimer's at Bryan Park. Nearly 500 people participated in a one-mile walk, which not only raised money, but also raised awareness of this disease and the latest research in the field. Alzheimer's is a neurodegenerative disease that affects older people. The number of people diagnosed with Alzheimer's increases each year as the American population ages. It is currently the sixth leading cause of death. Walk to End Alzheimer's is the Alzheimer's Association's largest fundraiser. Walks are held in cities throughout the country. The Indianapolis Walk to End Alzheimer's is ranked eighth largest in the country. It will be held on October 12th at Military Park.
Though CO2 emissions in the atmosphere continue to rise, Indiana's senior politicians are working hard to resist any carbon restrictions by the Environmental Protection Agency. Last week, the World Meteorological Organization released findings that the level of heat-trapping carbon dioxide in the atmosphere rose at a record-shattering pace last year. The scientists from this UN advisory body also expressed surprise at their findings and fear of the consequent acceleration of global warming and attendant climate change. The report went on to note that concentrations of nearly all the major greenhouse gases reached historic highs in 2013, reflecting ever-rising emissions from automobiles and smokestacks, but also a diminishing ability of the world's oceans and plant life to soak up the excess carbon put into the atmosphere by humans. Also last week, Indiana Governor Pence released a letter that he signed, along with 14 other state governors, addressed to President Obama asking him to veto the new greenhouse gas regulations proposed by the Environmental Protection Agency. These measures would reduce the permitted amount of greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. They are especially focused on coal-burning plants, which produce more CO2 than any other fuels. In order to comply, most older coal plants would have to undergo major upgrades, switch to cleaner fuels, or shut down. Governor Pence also dispatched Tom Easterly, the commissioner of Indiana's Department of Environmental Management, to tell a subcommittee on energy and power of the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Energy and Commerce that the new EPA regulations would, quote, cause significant harm to Hoosiers without providing any measurable offsetting benefits, unquote. Meanwhile, Indiana's Democratic Senator Joe Donnelly and Republican Senator Dan Coats, along with 50 other senators, published letters to similar effect. The senators requested a 60-day extension of the public comment period on the EPA's proposed rule. This extension would be on top of the current 120-day comment period. Senator Donnelly's announcement states that this extension is, quote, critical to ensure that state regulatory agencies and other stakeholders have adequate time to analyze and comment on the proposal, end quote. Senator Coates' announcement is more direct, stating that the proposed will, quote, restructure our entire electricity sector, kill reliable coal power, and raise energy prices, period, unquote. In response to the bipartisan petitions, the Obama administration added another 45 days of comment period. Meanwhile, global climate scientists think that the world's oceans have reached their capacity to absorb carbon, which means that levels in the atmosphere will increase at an even faster pace.
Local schools and utilities are slowly becoming involved in the effort to win a nationwide energy conservation competition. This summer, Monroe County passed the quarterfinals of the Georgetown University Energy Prize Contest. Communities are competing to track energy use and making plans to conserve. Ian Yarbrough, a member of the County Environmental Quality and Sustainability Commission, told the commission September 10th the local gas and electricity providers are mostly on board to help.
We have worked with Duke pretty closely this last week. And confirmed that they can, in fact, do the township-level reporting for the residential data, which is one of the hang-ups that we were kind of wondering about.
Ian?
Vectren originally said that they could do it. It was kind of a question-y, like a waffly, we can probably do it.
Information from the utilities would help determine hotspots for energy use in the county. Those working on the competition are also in talks with schools, including the Monroe County Community School Corporation. The second round of the competition will be judged in January. The community that wins the national prize will get $5 million to put towards conservation efforts.
Upper story corporate offices won't have to comply with one of Bloomington's newest rules. The City Council passed an amendment last week excluding those offices from its ordinance governing standardized businesses. The council passed that ordinance in June. It allows the city to regulate the design of new chain restaurants and chain stores downtown. Tom Makuta, the city's planning director, suggested changing the definition of standardized business to exempt the offices.
By city code, the signage for upper story office uses is limited to no more than 4 square feet at the entry point. So under any circumstances, you would never see a sign display bigger than 4 square feet at that building entry. That's as much as you get. So essentially what would happen is if we left them in as a standardized business, we would be reviewing that 4 square foot sign. I think that tells us what we need to know.
The amendment comes at the urging of at least two prominent businesses downtown. David Harstad, the owner of Summit Realty and a member of the city's Historic Preservation Commission, was the first to raise the issue in June, and Makuta said he also heard from CFC Properties, which is part of the Cook Group.
They're certainly affected as a major owner, and they have Fountain Square Mall, which includes a number of retail and office uses. Obviously, those office uses at some point could fall into the category of a standardized business office. So they were concerned that the process may be too cumbersome in regards to a second floor office use.
The Bloomington Chamber of Commerce opposed the standardized business ordinance when it was first proposed earlier this year. At that time, the proposed rule would have allowed city officials to refuse permits to chain businesses in order to prevent an overconcentration of chains downtown. But the council stripped that provision. The final version only regulates design of the businesses. The chamber now supports the ordinance. Larry Jacobs, a spokesman for the chamber, thanked the council for working with local business people on the most recent amendment.
I know that it took away some of your lunch hours and some times after 5 o'clock and to sit down and speak with us and kind of hammer this out. I'd also like to say thank you to the Plan Commission and to the Planning Department, and of course Patty for her due diligence with this project.
The council later voted unanimously to approve the exemption for upper story offices. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Kathy Norton.
And I'm Kelly Worley. Support for the Daily Local News comes from Smithville, a local provider of internet, phone, and TV service over a stabilized fiber optic network, serving Monroe, Greene, Owen, Lawrence, Brown, and Morgan counties. More information on Smithville's full line of services is available at 812-876-2211 or at smithville.net.
Jackson Creek Middle School is not in Bloomington. Neither is the Bloomington Country Club or the new Walmart location. These and other major players to Bloomington's economy are all located in the county-controlled urban enterprise zone. Tomorrow evening, there will be a public open house regarding the county's plan for this area. To find out more, WFHB News Director Allison Bechtesh spoke with Larry Wilson, Director of Planning for Monroe County, for today's community report.
Reporting for WFHB, this is Allison Bechtesh. I have on the phone with me Larry Wilson, who is the Director of the Monroe County Planning Department. Larry, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
Well, you have an event coming up tomorrow, Thursday, September 18th, from 6 to 9, for the public to find out a little bit more about the Monroe County Urbanizing Area Plan. And I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about that today, too. If you could start by letting me know, who is the project team? Who's working on this urbanizing plan?
The project team is a consulting group called MKSK. And they've been working on this plan along with some other companies that are sub-consultants. This is a plan that the urbanizing area is the area that is primarily what is called the old two-mile fringe. Years ago, the city of Bloomington exercised jurisdiction over areas 2 miles into the county that were not actually a part of the city. They were unannexed. And at some point, the legislature changed the law, and this reverted to the county probably around 1997, 1998. Since then, we have not really updated the plan for this area. This area is actually bigger than the city of Bloomington as it stands right now. So it's a huge area. There are a lot of important businesses and facilities in this area, such as the airport, Ivy Tech, Cook Company, a number of schools. And so it's really important that we look at this area and plan for the future, especially with I-69 going through the middle of it.
Can you tell me what stage of development you are currently in then?
We have proposed land uses and proposed designs for various types of development. And as part of the review process, we're inviting the public to come to the open house and look at the maps, look at the type of development and uses that might occur in this area, and give their opinion, and also become more informed about the process. So this is going to be a real opportunity for people to come learn about this area that is where a lot of the growth in Bloomington will likely occur, in the Bloomington area will occur over the next 30, 40 years, and give their input.
When we say growth, can you define that a little bit more? Does that mean literally building new buildings, and is that business, residential? What is the definition of growth when you're talking to a planner mean?
Well, I think it means either, it means basically activity on the real estate. Now, it may be things such as bike paths, new streets, new infrastructure, new sewer lines, water lines. It may be additional parks and greenways, or it may be a new industry or a new shopping area, a new mixed use. That's one of the things that the plan is addressing, is the opportunity for mixed uses in this area, similar to what's going on in downtown Bloomington, where you may have commercial on the lower floor and residential on the upper floor. One of the challenges of this area, it's not really set out in a grid. It's been developed sort of randomly over the years, and so you really don't have a downtown as such that would support the kind of walkable activities that that what's called the new urbanism encourages. But that's part of the project, is how do we set up development standards that encourage and allow this type of use? Right now, it would be very difficult under our present plan and ordinances to do a mixed-use structure where you have businesses on one floor and residents above, or split out a building with different uses. So that's part of the process. How do we make our plan and ultimately the zoning ordinance really appropriate for the kind of land uses that we're seeing? One of the things the planners have already identified is there is an increased desire of individuals to live within walking distance of shopping and their jobs and recreation. And that's across the board, but particularly for the younger generation called the millennials, and also the baby boomers that are retiring. They don't want to have to drive to go see a movie or go grocery shopping. And one of the challenges in this area, it's really set up for automobile access. And as part of the plan, we'll basically try to come up with ways that would increase the opportunity to really make walkable places, bikeable places, and places where people don't have to get in the car to go buy groceries or go to work or attend some type of a cultural or recreational event.
You mentioned that a large part of this, there is development already happening. Interstate 69 is coming through and being built there. I'm wondering what the people you've talked to, what they think of that, if that's good for business or if they're against that, especially being that you're trying to make this maybe a more walkable community. You don't usually think of an interstate when you think of riding your bike to the grocery.
Right. Well, one of the challenges is I-69, which basically, because it's cutting off access for a number of exits and a number of streets and roads, does create a barrier between sort of the old Bloomington and particularly the west side, which is primarily in our jurisdiction. You know, you can argue there, you know, even if you, the one thing that's clear is the road's going through. We know that. What we have to do is address the implications of that. For example, in Northern, on 37 right now, we have a number of businesses that are going to have to relocate, because they no longer have direct access or part of their property is being taken. Those are big issues. How do you, like, maintain these areas? How do you find new locations for the businesses? Particularly in the direct west side of I-69, there are challenges, particularly on pedestrian access, bicycle access. There's been a fairly strong push to make some kind of a underpass or overpass for bicycles. Most of the bridges and the overpasses will have pedestrian and bicycle areas. However, they will be adjacent to the traffic and probably subject to stoplights, which will create, I think, some difficulty. It's probably difficult now to get along 2nd and 3rd if you're a bicyclist or a pedestrian to get across 37. And it won't necessarily be better once the interstate goes in. But these are huge questions we have to address. The interstate's going to be here. We've got to look at what the impact will be. One thing the county did in the last year is we've created a couple of new ordinances. One is to deal with adult businesses because we had no provision. And that's one thing that sometimes comes with an interstate. And the second thing we do is we set up a standard for truck stops that would be built. We had no direct provisions for truck stops, and now we've established fairly stringent provisions so that if we do have a truck stop, the traffic coming off and on the interstate to the truck stop won't disrupt other local traffic. We have a number of environmental protections so that trucks won't be idling all night long, or provisions for spill cleanup, signage, and landscaping and buffering and all those things. So we have to try to be a little proactive, but there clearly will be some things that we won't know until the road's built and the traffic patterns start being established.
Larry, thank you for your time. I've been speaking with Larry Wilson, the director of the Monroe County Planning Department, about the development of the Monroe County Urbanizing Area Plan. For WFHB, this is Allison Bechtesh.
The Urbanizing Area Plan public open house is tomorrow, September 18th, from 6 to 9 p.m. at Jackson Creek Middle School. The consulting design firm will make presentations at 6 p.m. and 7:30 p.m.
Support for WFHB comes from Blooming Foods Market and Deli, your locally grown co-op grocery since 1976. Blooming Foods features natural, organic, local, and fair trade food and garden items with support for small farmers, co-op producers, and local food artisans. Blooming Foods Market and Deli on 2nd and Fess at Elm Heights, on East 3rd near College Mall, West 6th near the Courthouse Square, and right up your alley at Kirkwood and Dunn.
Up next, our weekly consumer watchdog segment, Bloomington Beware.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Bloomington Beware, WFHB's weekly consumer watchdog, with current advisories and hints designed to help keep your head out of the clouds, your feet on the ground, and your money in your pocket. Indiana Senator Joe Donnelly has released a report which is both timely and right on target for us. Timely because just 10 days ago was National Grandparents Day, and because Senator Donnelly held a special field hearing of the U.S. Senate Special Committee on Aging just last month at the Indiana State Fair. If you're a regular listener to this column, the results may sound like deja vu all over again. The report starts out with a scary, steep graph of national complaints at the Federal Trade Commission's Consumer Sentinel Network, showing a rise from under 200,000 back at the turn of the millennium to over 1.2 million last year. Last year alone, here in Indiana, there were almost 25,000 complaints filed. Hoosiers were swindled out of some $20 million. And the people who suffered most from these viciously wily schemes were Americans over 50 years old. Now, if you're not in that group, please help us spread the word to those who are. The FTC says, and I quote, "Scammers frequently target older Americans who tend to have more medical issues, are less savvy with new technology, and are generally more trusting," end quote. Identity theft is the single most reported scam in America, according to the Senate report, and some 37% of the victims were senior citizens. But seniors are victimized even more by three kinds of con jobs designed just for them. Imposter scams are the single most common. These crooks work the telephone. Older folks get a call from a muffled, vague voice claiming to be a nephew, niece, or grandchild who is in jail or stranded in some remote location and desperately needs cash wired to rescue him or her. The con artist relies on the bad phone connection, the sudden emotional upheaval, and the trusting gullibility of the grandma or grandpa to believe the spiel and send the money. Instead, stop, think, and call the alleged victim direct or call another family member first. Debt collection scares are next. Again, it's a phone call, but this time with a perfectly clear connection and a very authoritative voice who demands immediate payment and makes a drastic threat if the money isn't sent. The caller may claim to represent a financial institution or the local government, the police, or even the Internal Revenue Service. The debt can be a loan payment, a fine, or back taxes owed on personal property or income, and the threats involve lawsuits, arrest, or seizure of property or bank accounts. Of course, notification of any real debt comes in the U.S. mail, not on the phone. And the third most common senior scam works on greed instead of fear. It's a telephone call or an email announcing that the victim has won a sweepstakes or a contest. And the names of real contests are often used. But the kicker is that the supposed lucky winner is asked to send money to them before collecting the prize. Whether it's for taxes or processing fees or anything else, it's always bogus, especially if the winner can't remember entering the contest in the first place. Never pay money to get money. Now, all these scams are very urgent matters. Act quickly! And they all want money sent by wire transfer or prepaid money card so it cannot be traced or recovered. Help spread the word to your family and friends, and we can teach swindlers that the old saying, "There's no fool like an old fool," just ain't true in Indiana.
Bloomington Beware is produced in cooperation with the Central Indiana Better Business Bureau. The phone number for the Indianapolis office is 317-488-2222, or you can reach them online at indiebbb.org. For WFHB News and Public Affairs, I'm Richard Fish, reminding you that swindlers never give a sucker an even break.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB, supported by Smithville, your Indiana communications company at smithville.net, and by Blooming Foods Market and Deli, your locally grown co-op grocery. Today's headlines were written by Susan Northleaf along with Joe Crawford for Cats Week in partnership with Community Access Television Services. Bloomington Beware was produced by Richard Fish.
Our engineers today are Jim Lang, Adam Reichley, and Matt Gowaltney. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Managing producer is Joe Crawford. Executive producer is Allison Bechtesh. For WFHB, this is Kelly Worley.
And I'm Kathy Norton. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported independent daily news program. Recognized among the best newscasts and breaking news coverage in 2013 by the Indiana Professional Chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. Send inquiries to news at wfhb.org. Stay tuned for Standing Room Only, our award-winning weekly lecture series, coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.